This is Building Bridges with Ken Nash and Mamie Rosenberg. Michael Leite, preeminent spokesperson and expert on Medicare for All, fellow at the Sanders Institute and delegate to the Democratic National Convention, have progressives thrown in the towel? Or can we expect virtual floor fights from activists who want the Democratic Party to set a more progressive policy course for the 99%? Thank you for joining us. Michael, I'm so glad to have you on because you're going to tell me, I dare say, you're going to tell our listeners that there's still a fight for the soul of the Democratic Party, meaning that there's still going to be some fight over platform issues, that it's not entirely sewn up, and that there's some way, notwithstanding that certainly our position is we're going to vote. We are going to vote, and we are going to vote for the Biden-Harris ticket. But are there any issues that are being fought to move the platform on any issues to the left as we are about to get started with the Democratic National Convention?
Absolutely. You know, the fight over Medicare for All is by no means over. And in fact, we're looking at 750, 800 delegates, maybe more, who are going to reject the platform because it doesn't include Medicare for All. And the disconnect between the level of popular support for Medicare for All, particularly among Democrats, which in some polls approaches 90%, and the leadership position, that gap is huge and delegitimizing for the Democratic leadership. They've got a real problem. They've got a base that demands this reform. They've got a huge chunk of delegates who are going to reject their platform because of this reform, not being in it. It's a fight. Congress, Ro Khanna, chair of the California delegation, the largest delegation in the convention, voting against the platform because it doesn't include Medicare for All. He's a leading proponent of Medicare for All in Congress, has got a bill to enable states to do Medicare for All. There's going to be a fight at the convention, or at least, you know, a virtual fight over the course of the convention. And this issue isn't going away between now and November. And then after November, everyone is pledging that they're not going to let Biden-Harris administration off the hook when it comes to passing health care reform in Congress. This is going to continue to animate the progressives in the Democratic Party, and it's going to continue to put the Democratic leadership on the spot versus their donor class, versus the needs of their rank and file and of workers throughout the country.
And after the platform fight is over, assuming that Biden wins, what do the delegates propose to do? I heard that they propose to vote down the entire platform.
No, that's the point. They're going to vote against the platform, right? This chunk of delegates, either, I think we're approaching 800 now who have pledged to do so. It's not yet enough to defeat the platform. You've got some Biden delegates who are committed to voting no on the platform because it doesn't include Medicare for All. And there's some others, of course, in the background, the fights over Medicare for All, but there's also real anger at the failure to support the legalization of cannabis, marijuana, and also the failure to really hold Israel to account for its occupation of the West Bank. So I think that's also kind of in the background, and the explicit fights over Medicare for All, and the delegates are going to, over the course of the convention, vote no on the platform because of it.
You mentioned a few people, but who is it and how that people have been organizing, and particularly against the control and the ferocity of the control that has traditionally been exhibited by the Democratic National Committee? They control the platform. And so what opportunity has there been on these issues that you've mentioned to organize and to give some sense that there's some elasticity there?
It's been a process. Initially, the task forces that were set up between the Biden and Bernie campaigns were an effort to, you had a majority of the healthcare task force, for example, including people from the Biden side who are on record supporting Medicare for All, and all the Bernie folks were. So there was a fight during the Unity Task Force, and out of that emerged a much better plan than what Vice President Biden had ran on. Then we had the opportunity to go into the platform drafting committee, and again, representatives from the Bernie campaign pushed hard. Then when we got to the actual platform committee meeting itself a couple of weeks ago, we introduced a resolution to put in Medicare for All, support for Medicare for All, into the platform. I advocated for it during the platform committee meeting, and we were unsuccessful. We got kind of creamed, actually. A lot of those votes, though, were from people who were appointed, just as you say, by the DNC, by Tom Perez. It wasn't even necessarily Biden delegates, although they were voting no. It was also the party-appointed delegates, really representing the donor class. And then finally, Judith Whitmer, head of the Nevada delegation, organized through the Bernie Delegates Network this effort to then get pledges from delegates to vote against the platform because it doesn't include Medicare for All. And she'd introduced a resolution to the platform committee to support Medicare for All. One of the big victories we got along the way was that the Minnesota delegation as a whole, not just the Bernie delegates, but the Minnesota Democratic Farmer Labor Party delegation to the Democratic National Convention voted in majority to reject the platform because it doesn't include Medicare for All. So you've got, that's a major state delegation in a state that is pretty tight. It may not have gone to Trump last time, but it was within a few thousand votes of doing so. A very strong statement coming out of Minnesota led by the nurses. So I think we got to credit the Bernie Delegates Network. We got to credit Judith Whitmer from Nevada. You've got to credit Minnesota, the folks who are on these different committees representing the Bernie campaign. And now Ro Khanna, as I mentioned, head of the California delegation, leading the charge for, we hope, other members of Congress to step up, too, and vote against the platform.
So what signals does this send out to the voters in terms of people sort of assume that once you got a nominee, everybody's going to follow in lockstep? Now, what does this send out to the voters in terms of voting for Biden, but being able to disagree and to organize once the election is over?
Yeah, I think it's a somewhat unique position, right? There is not lockstep support for this nominee. There is a rejection of the neo-fascism and white supremacy of the Trump-Pence administration. There's a recognition that we need fundamental change and that Biden-Harris is our vehicle to pressure at the presidential level for that change. But there's a lot of organizing going on among state legislative candidates, district attorneys, and obviously the Senate and Congress. And we're expecting, I mean, look what's happened in New York. You all know better than I. We're looking at a much more progressive House, probably. We certainly, the Democrats have a shot at taking back the Senate. So this agitation goes all the way down the ballot and recognizes that it's going to be going back up from the grassroots to the administration if they prevail. So I think the signal is quite different from what is usually sent, that we're just going to like, oh, we're just going to follow their lead. No, we're going to try to continue to have them follow our lead.
One of the things that occurred was that there was an indication that somebody with the popularity, particularly amongst the youth of the country, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, is going to be given 1 minute, 60 seconds to speak. One might say it's a victory that she's given any time. However, my cynicism takes over again and the fight for the soul of the party by saying that this is another indication of the categorical rejection. And I think much to my dismay that the Democratic Party is misreading the electorate. But to what extent do you think such things as giving AOC 1 minute to speak flies in the face of the ability to really alter the platform as it is presently constituted, and even come up with something like saying, aha, Medicare for All, single payer, during the period of pandemic, if nothing else. So deal with my cynicism.
You know, I gotta tell you, I had the same reaction about how they are limiting Representative Ocasio-Cortez's time. There are two things, though, on the platform itself. First of all, even if we don't have the numbers to get close to formal rejection of the platform, it just doesn't happen. You get 25-30% even of delegates voting against your party's platform, particularly on a key issue like Medicare for All that was so defining in the primary. That simply doesn't happen. The Democratic Party has a legitimation crisis. going on. And it's a legitimation crisis, as I mentioned, between the base and the donor class-driven leadership. AOC is right in the middle of that. AOC represents a challenge to donor-driven leadership, and she did from the first day she was in Congress when she went into Speaker Pelosi's office. So they really don't know how to deal with that challenge. And the fact is they're timid, and last I heard, there are no Muslim speakers at the convention. Geez, even Hillary Clinton in 2016 had Muslim speakers.
Mm-hmm.
It is a very wary, timid, and I think over their head in a way, leadership of the party. They don't really know how to corral and lead the forces that are at work at the base of this party. So I think you're right to be cynical about how they're treating the convention and limiting the spectrum of debate, and including someone like John Kasich is outrageous. I mean, imagine if your NARAL and Planned Parenthood, which have been the backbone of a lot of the National Democratic Party fights over the last decades, and they're putting an anti-choice leader to speak at the convention, a former Republican governor. So, I think they're over their heads, and I don't think that they know how to really lead, and so they're taking a very kind of authoritarian approach that's going to backfire.
Here, there's a moment we have here, whether one thinks it's a moment or a movement. The fact of the matter is that Black Lives Matter has influenced the world community. And I'm just wondering if you have any insights into, aside from the reality of the lineage of Kamala Harris herself, but substantively, are there any positions that are going to change or be more progressive, if you will, to deal with the issue that has fired up the entire world, which is the structural issues of beginning the process of dismantling white supremacy? Is there any indication that this is going to be something that is tackled in the platform committee or otherwise?
I don't think the platform is going to change further. I think it is very progressive on criminal justice reform. And absent the racial justice uprising and the creation, really, I think, of where we are in the third Reconstruction period, absent the protests over George Floyd's murder, we would, Joe Biden be running a much more conventional campaign on criminal justice. Let's face it, even with some of the momentum that predated Floyd's murder, he was basically compelled to choose a black woman. And frankly, Karen Bass was truly in the running, and she's a very progressive person. The fact that Senator Harris was chosen among the choices, she's probably on the progressive side of the choices, not the most progressive by any means. And so this is a radical opportunity, and one that I think the Biden-Harris administration has to deliver on. They're going to have to challenge in a systemic way structural racism. They're going to have to challenge, as you say, white supremacy. They're going to have to dramatically improve the material condition of black folks, as well as Latinos and indigenous folks and others like Asian Pacific Islanders who've been very affected by COVID. They're going to have to address the racial disparities. That's going to be part of their problem with their non-Medicare for All health care plan, because it can't really establish health equity in a way that Medicare for All does. So this is really where it's at. The base of the Democratic Party, the most loyal voters in the Democratic Party, black women especially, are demanding a level of change and fundamental reorganization of society and economy that I think is going to determine the success or failure of this administration. So they are really on the hook in a way. And, initially, as you know, Vice President Biden just wanted to kind of run a restoration campaign, right? We're just going to go back to the pre-Trump world. Well, that is just so off the table now. And the demands are so profound that really their success depends upon delivering a level that I think they could never have anticipated. But let's face it, when we're talking about a jobs guarantee, when we're talking about a housing guarantee, when we're talking about guaranteed health care through Medicare for All, when we're talking about ending mass incarceration, defunding the police, we're talking about shifting the money from oppression and the wealthy to working folks, and particularly the black and Latino working class. That is what's on the agenda. And I think that is the context, and that's going to be what is really going to animate, the kind of tax the rich reforms, the spending that we're going to see related to COVID, what's going to animate the jobs and housing spending. All those things are going to essentially be animated by the demand, but I am certain that that is really ultimately the motivating force.
So you're saying one way or the other, and Ken certainly sparked you there. Michael, you reminded me of a very glorious, several glorious moments of the Hillary campaign, or shall we say the Democratic National Convention last time, when the mothers of people who had been killed by police came out and spoke. Mm-hmm. Trayvon Martin's mother, a number of other. You reminded me of that glorious moment when some of our Muslim brothers and sisters did get out and speak and tore to shreds the understanding that Trump has of the nature of immigration and indeed mm-hmm. the constitutional basis for the promise of democracy being realized in this country. And you reminded me of the Reverend Barber, who also came out, who has a sparkling and important agenda to deal with the 140 plus million people that are poor in this country. So is there any kind of expectation that the Democratic Party understands the imperative to reach beyond the status quo, or what it thinks of as the status quo, which has been largely running against Trumpism and not for much else? Will there be manifestations of immigrants beyond the tears which are evoked over the separation policies at the border? Will there be, either in terms of representatives of these movements or statements made about a real economic renewal, not business as usual, that you think that we're going to see during the couple of days of the virtual Democratic National Committee, which frankly, whether it was in person or it's by Zoom, is not all that virtual. It is very often our future.
Well, I think in this case, it's not. I think this convention is not going to capture the moment. I don't think it's by any means reflects the racial justice uprising movement, certainly not the movement for Medicare for All. And I just don't think it is going to be a convention that is representative of what's actually happening in American politics, and particularly among Democratic constituencies. I think there is a real potential for disappointment. I think it's a kind of make no mistake, be safe, and really not take any chances. As I say, there's a timidity, a cautiousness, a lack of bold leadership. There are quite a few old hands. You look at the news reports and the people around Vice President Biden, been around him for 30, 40 years. Not a dynamic crew in many respects. And I think part of the reason that Senator Harris was selected is because she brings a level of energy and dynamism and charisma. And I think she's moved toward progressive positions that they know are much more likely to be engaging and the future of the party. So I don't think this convention is going to reflect what's actually going on by any means. I mean, really, as you say, if you're giving AOC 60 seconds, you're really not capturing the moment, let's face it.
And to what extent do you think that the forces that are on hand to oppose this platform will stick together after the Democratic convention?
100%. But here's the question, though, Ken. Here's the question. Is there going to be a force in Congress that's going to hold out for a real debate over Medicare for All versus the public option, that's going to demand that states like New York, where there's huge momentum to pass single payer, will actually have the tools from the federal government to do so in whatever reform is passed at the national level? Are we really going to be able to coalesce as a movement and put real pressure on the donor-driven leadership in the U.S. House and move those senators who clearly very rarely give a hoot about actual working people. So there are real questions there, but I think what we're going to see is, I mean, you're already seeing it. You're already saying, okay, we're going to stick together now. We're going to, you know, vote as a block against the platform. We're going to organize. We're not going to give up on this issue between now and November. And then after November, we're going to keep fighting. It's not, you would say, logical, well, after we give them power, they're going to be more receptive to us. But what the fact is that we're just going to organize harder. And there are going to be a lot of members of Congress. I've heard that members of Congress who now aren't going to sign on to H.R. 1384, the Medicare for All bill, are going to do so after the election. That would be a sign. Obviously, we've seen the power of Medicare for All in the New York congressional primaries with Jamal Bowman and Mondaire Jones winning their primaries. We're seeing it in the Ed Markey versus Joe Kennedy race, where Markey's pressing hard on Medicare for All, and Kennedy's on the defensive on it. He's very late to the game. So those indications are there's going to be a political impact that will continue to be felt in November, and it's going to have an impact on the next Congress.
So you're saying one way or the other, and Ken certainly sparked you there, and you ignited with that spark. Boots on the ground. There are boots on the ground dealing with the Democratic National Convention, and we expect and we know that they must continue vigorously afterwards to move beyond business as usual, and to a really strike back at these terrifying viruses politically and health-wise that have been beleaguering the populace.
Yeah, I really do. I really think we're in the opposite moment from Obama in 2008, where we thought, oh, wow, okay, this cool, you know, black guy is now president. We're golden, right? He's going to take care of it. And there was not, I remember doing a demonstration against the Obama Treasury Department in 2011. It was the first such demonstration from the left and labor. And we're just not going to be in that kind of situation again. This is from day one. These are, you know, demands that are going to be pressed from day one. People are going to be mobilized, and we're already mobilized at a much higher level, and that's going to continue, and it's not going to drop off. And I think there's a recognition that the only reason we are where we are is because of the uprising and because of the mobilization and the movement building and the organizing. And that realization is not going away.
Well, Ken and I are always building bridges, and we've got our picket signs on the ready. Got my traveling and marching shoes on, albeit socially distanced, albeit masked and ready to go. And, Michael, thank you for your analysis. Thank you for your education, perseverance, and leadership to giving us some sense of what might occur at the Democratic National Convention and what must occur, notwithstanding the results of that, going forward, so that we do have Medicare for All, so that we do have, by any other name, reparations, so that we do have the empowerment of the working class. You've been great.
Thank you so much. It was a real pleasure, and we cannot, of course, forget the climate crisis as well, and that is underlying all of this. And so thank you so much for taking this time and giving me this time.
So wait a minute. You can't get away with that. You're absolutely right. That was one of the pillars that we hadn't mentioned. So you seem to be, and I believe there are some extra notes of belief that the Biden candidacy will mean some good things for the environment.
Well, let's face it. If you look at the Energy Task Forces and you look at the kind of the lay of the land since the primary, there was real progress made on toward the Green New Deal and addressing emissions. But of course, the bottom line is, and he even, you know, put forward a ban on future fracking, right? But the bottom line is you got to keep the fossil fuels in the ground. And it may look good politically to say, okay, now we're going to get zero emissions in 2035 instead of 2030, but it doesn't matter if we're at, you know, 2 degrees Celsius in 2035. No matter how it looks politically, it's got to work to actually keep the fossil fuels in the ground and actually transform the economy into a renewable-based energy system. So I think there's real progress there, but we can't. COVID has kind of obscured the reality that there's no alternative, right, to addressing the climate crisis and establishing climate justice by keeping it in the ground and reorganizing the economy. And so we really need to understand even something like Medicare for All or a jobs program as part of the Green New Deal, because that's what's going to ultimately save us, is if we're successful in doing that. And of the issues we've talked about, in some ways there is real indications that there's openings there for even more progress. And I think the science and the reality is going to compel it. So we can never forget that that's our underlying reality.
Michael Luddy, keep on fighting.
I'm Mimi Rosenberg with Ken Nash, and you've been listening to Building Bridges. Stay strong, stay well.